I'm Judy Pierce, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come here this weekend. This has been a lovely weekend. I'm always flattered when I'm asked to share at any roundup. I'm always flattered when I'm asked to be anywhere in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or any place, because for so many years I was usually asked to leave, you know, not to come, to stay with them, and so it's really an honor. And I also get very excited when I'm asked to do this, and I thank the committee for allowing me that opportunity, because I'm real excited about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm real excited about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's done for me, and I'm real grateful that I'm given the opportunity to share what it's done for me. Our stories disclose that they tell us in instructions in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like now. And I keep it about as general as I can. It was suggested to me one time that perhaps it'd be a little more ladylike if I cleaned it up. But if I cleaned up my story, I wouldn't have a story. So so I just tell it like it was, or like I was, and it's my story, and I can't change that. And every time I'm forced to think about what I was when I got here and what I brought to you people, I stand again in awe of the program. I'm one of those alcoholics who truly believe that this was the only thing that was going to work. This was the only thing that could work for me. And I am a miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I brought to you in December of 72 a 23-year-old woman who was eat up with hate, and who was bitter, and who was cold, and didn't care about living anymore. And it's hard for me to really believe sometimes that that was really me, because of the way I feel on the inside now, you know. And like so many others that get to the fellowship, I had done all the things that we were supposed to do. You know, I'd gone to see a psychiatrist. My mother sent me. I'd spent some time in a hospital. I'd attempted suicide. I'd done a lot of those things. And I was one of those that about 2 weeks before I came into the program, a physician and a psychiatrist suggested to my mother that she commit me, because I was not only a danger to her, I was a danger to other people and to myself. And that the only way that she would be able to cope at all was to have me put away. And that's what I brought to y'all and said, fix it. I came from a Polish Catholic home, and that kind of tells you I was doomed for this place on the onset. You know? And Polacks drink a lot, and it was not, the point of that being is that liquor was not frowned upon in my home. Heavy drinking wasn't frowned upon in my home. Getting drunk periodically wasn't frowned upon. It wasn't a sin. We were Catholics. It was okay to drink, you know. And what was frowned upon in my case was that the manner in which I drank and what I did when I drank. And women were not supposed to be alcoholics. Women were not supposed to drink the way I drank. I started drinking very young, and I'll talk to you a lot about the way I felt, not because we need to discuss my feelings, but because I think that there's universal feelings amongst alcoholics. And I remember when I watched the movie on Bill W., I remember him saying in that movie that he always felt apart from, and he always felt different from. And that was the way I always felt. As a child, I stuttered horribly, and it took me forever to complete a sentence, and I felt apart from. As a child, I read a lot, and I read a lot of the Grimm's fairy tales, you know, and I could get into those fairy tales and stay there because that's where it was safe for me. It seemed to me like most of my life I was frightened. I was always frightened, and I never could tell you really what up, you know. My mother was divorced when I was a young girl, and remarried about a year thereafter, and I liked my stepfather in the beginning. I thought he was a nice guy, you know. I didn't know, and we didn't know, that my mother had married an alcoholic in the early stages of alcoholism. And, you know, in all defense to our Al-Anon sisters, when an alcoholic's in the early stage of alcoholism, you know, they get drunk every now and then, but they got such a good personality, and they're a lot of fun, and they're sensitive, and they're exciting, and you know, but the problem being, most of us hang around too long. See, and it goes, the disease progresses, and then we have, like, as we had with my stepfather, Jekyll Hyde. Because this was a man who was loving and caring and sensitive to the needs of others. And the more he drank, the more he was just the opposite of it. The more he drank, the more selfish he became, the more bitter he became, the harder he became, you know. Then his anger erupted, and his anger erupted in the way that it does a lot of alcoholics on. And I was an abused child. You know, I was sexually abused and I was physically abused. And that's just part of my story. And I share that because I want you to know that you can stay sober if you come from that kind of environment. You see, I'm one of those that came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not patting myself on the back. I am, however, praising this program. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't gone back out since. You know, you can come to AA and go to your first meeting, and it will be your first meeting forever. You know, you don't have to go back out and drink again. You don't have to let your past haunt you. No. One of the things I learned here was that I had to come clean about everything. I learned that I am as sick as my secrets. So I had to come clean about it all. And it took a while. But in this home, and the violence started, and I guess I was about 14 years old, and I was starting to grow up and grow out a little bit. And I remember my stepfather took a swing at me, and he hit, and I got up off the floor, and I said, you know, I don't have to take this anymore. I just don't have to take this anymore. And I threw my first punch, and it hit him right on the jaw. And I remember thinking, God, that felt good. Now, and it really did. But the thing was that I became just as addicted to fighting as I did to alcohol. Now, I took my first drink at the age of 10. I loved everything about alcohol. I always did. I never had any trouble adjusting to any kind of alcohol or learning to like it. It just came real natural for me. I didn't have to force myself to drink anything. Any particular brand or whatever was around or whatever I could steal was what I drank. So that wasn't a problem, and that was the way it was from the first drink. I took my first drink at 10, and I wanted my second. You know. And then with all the anger and the hostility that built up in my home, the drink just made it all better. Another thing, too, that I remember about myself is everything hurt. Everything that went on about me hurt. And I'm not talking about just in my home, but I'm talking about things that were going on in our society. You know, the Vietnam War was a big issue then, and there were a lot of people fighting about that war. Not only in the war itself, but at home, too. And I can remember going to bed, and that would just worry me. Things like that would keep me up at night. You know, there were a lot of race riots on the streets of our cities, and you turn the TV on, and you see people getting beat with billy clubs and bitten by German Shepherd dogs, and it was a nightmare. It was just a nightmare. And I'd go to bed, and I couldn't sleep thinking about that stuff. You know, but I'd get up and take a few pops off that bottle, and everything was all right. Everything was all right. You know, it made it all go away. It made it all go away. And it worked for me. And I think that the thing for me that was so difficult when I came to this program was to accept the fact that anything that had worked that good could be that bad for me. You know? Because it just fixed whatever was wrong. Whether it was wrong inside of me or wrong out on the streets, it fixed it. You know? It made me feel better. It made me feel at ease. You know, even though I was raised in this kind of environment, I want you folks to know that I had a mother that loved me very much. And I had a grandmother that cared about me very much. And I knew the rules. I knew what was right and I knew what was wrong. They taught me that, and they taught me that well. You know, but as I grew older, it got tougher and tougher to follow the rules. You know, just got too tough. And so I elected to go the easier, softer way. But a lot of times during my drinking, I knew what I was doing was wrong. but it just didn't matter. It was too tough to cut it the right way, you know. So I chose the easier, softer way. My easier, softer way led to, I left home really about the normal time. I guess I was about 19 or 20. And I had a nice little job in a department store at Rich's, and I wasn't there too long, and I got promoted, and you know how we alcoholics do, we fall upstairs, and I did. And of course, my mother was so happy, and because she had already had some grave concerns about my drinking, and she was so happy, and she knew now there was nothing wrong with her little girl. Because, you know, if there was really something wrong with her little girl, certainly she wouldn't have a manager's job at Rich's. I had 20 women working under me. You know, I was 19 years old. There's nothing wrong with my daughter. So she wrote this wonderful letter to the Queen Polack up in Michigan to tell her how great Judy was doing, you know. Everybody knew. Everybody knew what my drinking was like. You know, and it was a cover-up. And we are achievers, and in my case, I can't speak for yours, but in my case, it was because I had to prove to myself I was okay. You know, I had to prove to myself I was okay. But the thing is, I never could last long at these jobs. I never could. And shortly after I got that position, I got ticked off and I quit, and there was a series of events that are really irrelevant. So I quit that job, and I made a brilliant decision based on clear alcoholic thinking. And that was that I needed to get in the bar and restaurant business. Because I knew that that's where I would find, well, see, being Catholic, and I'm 21 now, and I'm supposed to be married and have at least two kids by now. And everybody had always told me, you know, if you just get married and settle down with the right man, you'd stop all this stuff. You know, so I thought, well, bar would be a good place to meet a husband. And so I got a job at a bar, and I worked several bars in the Atlanta area. And as my drinking progressed, I went from working some of the best bars to some real dives because I couldn't hold a job, you know. As my drinking progressed, and I was a daily drinker, I was a daily drinker. I wasn't one that just drank periodically. I drank every day. Every time I could get my hands on it. And working in a bar, that was just great, you know. And I was single and I was 21 years old and all the guys wanted to buy me a drink. You know, and it really didn't matter because if they didn't buy it, I'd buy it myself. It didn't bother me. And at this bar, at this particular bar I started off with, that bar closed at midnight. And we'd all go out to a little bar called Between Places on Roswell Road. And I used to drink there, and Rusty, the girl that owned the place, had locked the doors at 2 because that's the only time you had to quit drinking legally at 2. So she'd lock the doors, but all the bar and restaurant people were there, and we'd all sit around and drink. And we'd drink a lot of times till that sun came up. You know? And this is a part of my story that sometimes makes people a little bit nervous, and that's okay. But see, I'd get in those bars and I'd get struck lonely, you know. I just didn't want to go home to that apartment alone again. So I'd sit there and I'd look at the ones that were sitting up in the bar and size one up that I wanted, and I'd go in for a kill. No. And that's it. And I'd take him home. And I'm not talking about once in a while. I'm talking about this got to be every night. Because of that loneliness. I didn't want to be alone. You know. And then I'd get him back home and say, God, what are you doing here? You know. Not wanting to be alone, but not wanting anybody with you either. And just feeling that emptiness inside and hoping maybe this is the one. Maybe this is the one that can make me feel like a whole person. Maybe this is the one that can fix me. And the next morning, realizing he wasn't. And so the next night, the same thing. And now when I realized in sobriety the chances I took, you know, I realized that, but drunk, I didn't care. I didn't care. You know. I just wanted to fall in love and do the things you were supposed to do. So I'd go out and I'd pick these guys up and I'd bring them home. And they'd spend the night. And, you know, a lot of times when I go to conventions, I hear my male counterparts talking about all these dogs they woke up with. And I want to tell you guys, you don't look so good the morning after either. The first time I heard a male speaker at a convention say, "Boy, I picked up some dogs," I looked at him and I thought, "What do you think you are, Prince Charming, you know?" Where do you guys think these women ended up? They're right here in these rooms, you know. Oh, well. But you served your purpose at the time, just like we did. I don't know why I say things like that, you know? I guess because it's true. I don't know. You know, there's something that happens to you on the inside when you live like that, and that, for lack of a better term, I began to rot on the inside. I could feel myself just kind of dying inside, you know? I just didn't care anymore. I didn't care, and I was running with a wild bunch of people and people who weren't the cream of society's crop, that's for sure. And I didn't care. You know, and my mother was giving me the looks that only a mother can give when you've totally disappointed her one more time. You know, and it was getting harder and harder for me to hold a job and earn a living, and that was something that just didn't go in my family. No, I just couldn't cope. It's just getting rougher and rougher. And as I said, I was having a hard time holding jobs. And I called a guy I'd met in the bar and restaurant business, and this guy's name was Pearl. And I told Pearl that I was out of work, and I was out of money, and I was out of sugar daddies. And I went to work for Pearl that night as a hooker on the streets of Atlanta. Because that's what I had to do. Now, and I would... Sometimes I look back at that and I thought, what else could you have done? And I'm here to tell you, as best as I can be, as honest as I can be at this point, I didn't know what else to do. I am a firm believer that the height of my sickness, if I could have done better, I would have. But I couldn't. And I can remember going in and out of those flea bag motels and hotels in Atlanta. And back then, the working girl wore white go-go boots, black fishnet hose, and satin hot pants. Mine were green satin. And halters and those big hoop earrings, the ones, you know, real big, about the size of a tire. And go out and walk those streets. And I can remember coming in and out of those places and thinking as I was walking out, you know, what are you doing here? You don't belong here. You were raised on the best side of Atlanta. What's the matter with you? You know, you don't belong here. But you get back to that room, you take a couple pops off the bottle, see, and it doesn't matter anymore. It just doesn't matter anymore because it all goes away. You know, it wasn't at this point that I wanted to feel good. It wasn't at this point that I wanted to feel anything. I just wanted out. I didn't want to feel at all. You know, and that's what it was doing for me. That's what it was doing for me. And sometimes I'll talk to people after meeting and they say, I don't believe I ever could have done that. Let me tell you something, honey. You want to drink bad enough, you'll sell your soul to Satan. It doesn't make any difference. When you know that the very fact that you're taking a breath, or if you have to keep on breathing, you're going to have to drink, you'll do it. You know, you'll do it. Because you have to. You just have to. You know, it's just, you just survive, man. You're not living, you're just surviving. As long as that went on, and the more people I met out on the streets, and the more I was abused, and the more I fought, the colder I got. You know, I made a decision sometime after I left the bar and restaurant business that I would never love again, and I'd never ever hurt like I did. And that from now on, if anybody was going to hurt, it was going to be them. And I took that to heart, and I carried that with me. And if the guys that I was engaged to or the guys that I was going with came up to me and said that I had hurt them because I cheated on them, that's tough luck, sucker. You should have seen it coming. You know, that's just too bad. I don't want you in my life anyway. And I had bought that. I had said those kind of things so many times that I was beginning to believe it in here. And to this day, I'm a big believer for the alcoholic. It's when I'm buying my own stuff, I'm in the deepest trouble. You know, when I'm buying my own lies and accepting them as truth, that's when I'm in the deepest trouble. Because I bought that, you know, and I didn't care. And I put a cloak or a wall around me where I didn't feel nothing, because I didn't want it. I put a cloak and a wall around me where I couldn't see the tears in my mama's eyes anymore, where I couldn't see the disappointment. No, I just couldn't see it anymore. I just didn't care. And I really felt like I was kind of in a little bobble all to myself. And all of you were out there, but I had nothing to do with you. And I didn't want anything to do with you. And if I saw anybody that was happy or looked like they were enjoying life, I remember thinking, what right do you have? What right do you have to enjoy life? Don't you know what's really going on out here? You know, why don't you pull your head out of the sand and look at these people? I hated them. I hated them. For no other reason, just they looked happy. That didn't last too long for me because physically I was getting real sick. I didn't eat on a regular basis. Never did when I was drinking. And I was falling apart. And one night I just lost it and went berserk. And I called my mother. Long short of that is I ended up at a DMHI, and I was to reside there for 6 months and ran a real good scam on the psychiatrist, and he let me out on a 3-hour pass, and I'm still out on that 3-hour pass. He believed me, because you know how we are. We promise we'll be back. And in a way, though, you know, and God works in mysterious ways. He works in mysterious ways because I started, that's where I started to come to you all in the most awkward of ways. I went out, and of course there was a man waiting for me. There was always a man waiting for me. That was my second addiction was men. God, I loved them. And they almost killed me, just like Boohoo's, you know, but it was my second addiction. And he was waiting for me there at the gates, and we took off. And I don't remember what happened. I don't remember anything about what happened. I remember somewhere between 10 and 14 days later, somebody came to another flea bag motel to pick me up. And they took me to my mother's home, and they poured me off in a pouch in her den. And my mother came home that day to find her 23-year-old daughter 10 to 14 days without a bath or a change of clothes, and stinking from booze and sleeping with me. And this is her firstborn child. This wreck of a human being is her daughter. Now, there is a line in our big book that says, we think the man is unthinking who thinks that sobriety is enough. Okay? And I believe that, because sobriety is not enough for me to make amends to my mother. The fact that I'm sober may be enough for her, but it's not for me. You see, because what did I do to her that day? And what did I do to her the day that the psychiatrist told her to have me committed? And what did I do to her the day that I fell off the sofa because I was so drunk I couldn't sit up and we had a house full of company? What did I do to her those days? How many times did I break her heart? How many times did I spit on the way that she fell towards me? How many times did I cuss her? How many times did I embarrass her? And just one time going up and saying, Mom, I'm sorry. Is that going to cut it? Not for me. Not for me, it's not. You know? So on a daily basis, I am the best daughter I can be to my mother. And it's in those little things that I try to say, I'm sorry, Mom, and I'm trying to do better. It's in those little things like when she calls me and she wants to talk to me about the things that are going on in her life that I have time. It's little things like taking her to Shoney's for a breakfast bar. She loves Shoney's breakfast bar. You know? It's those little things. Or taking her shopping on a Saturday. It's those things. That's the way I make amends. I'm sorry, it's just words. You see, I was taught that this is a program of action. You know, I can talk it all I want. It's how I walk it that makes the difference. And I really feel that I walk this program with my family today. And my mother doesn't have to worry about coming home and finding her daughter drunk on the couch anymore. My mother doesn't cry over this daughter anymore. Not anymore. No, and you all did that. You all taught me how to do that. I tried to commit suicide after that. After I dried out a little bit, and Mother wouldn't let me see one of these guys I was running with, and so I just tipped up a bottle of pills and waited to die. It was no big deal. I didn't write any note. I waited till everybody went to bed, and I just didn't care, you know? And it seemed like the thing to do at the time, so I went in the kitchen, I tipped up a bottle of pills, I sat down in the den, and I waited to die. You know? And once again, God was working in my life because my kid sister got up, and I had no idea why. You know, she'd seen me drunk more than she'd seen me sober. How'd she know I just didn't pass out again? But I ended up at the hospital, and that's when they told Mom to put me away. And Mama couldn't do that, so what she did was she told me the following day, you pack your bags and you get out. I'm sick of you and I'm sick of your behavior, and you're not welcome here. No more. That was the greatest thing my mother ever did for me. No more. For the first time in my life, she said, Judy, your behavior is your responsibility, and I'm not covering up for you anymore. And I went to live with my cousin Joanne, and I love this lady so very much. And Joanne was one of those who knew about alcoholism. Joanne had read about alcoholism, you know, and she knew that if she just talked to me right and used the right psychology, that I'd quit drinking. She knew it. To make a long story short, inside of 3 weeks, Jill said to me, you got to pack your bags and go. I've never seen anybody drink like you. And that was in December. And I was not feeling good that day, and I was not in the mood for an argument. And I became very bitter and very arrogant towards her. I said, I'll go. I don't need you, and I don't need anybody else. You know, I don't know what you're trying to save my soul for anyway. And I get ready to storm out the door, and I looked outside, and it was cold. It was real cold, and there was ice on the stairs. And I remember thinking to myself, where are you going to go? And it was cold reality that hit me because I was 23 years old. I didn't have one person I could call and say, come get me. Not one. Not one. I couldn't even call Mama. No place. And it was as though God spoke to me in a lingo I'd understand. Because he said, the jig's up, kid. You got to do something. And for the first time that I could ever remember it, you know, I realized it was up to me. But this time, there wasn't blaming anybody else. This time, there wasn't copping out anymore. This time, it was me. You know, the person that had loved me all my life had thrown me out. You know, this cousin that was just as close to a sister, close to me as a sister, even closer really, had told me to get out. And there was nobody to blame anymore than me. You know, and I don't know why I told her to call AA, but she did. And I'd heard something about y'all, and I saw a movie once when I was a very young child about Alcoholics Anonymous. And they called the central office, and they told me somebody would be there at the house at 7:15 to pick me up to go to my meeting. And it was a wonderful 12-step call. It was a glorious 12-step call. I started getting ready at 5. And Joe had to help me bathe. And she had to loan me a decent outfit to wear because I didn't have any clothes for civilian wear, you know. I needed something to cover my body, and I just didn't have anything. So she loaned me a little suit, and you got to picture this, because this, to me, in my mind, I have to giggle every time I think about it. My hair was real, real long and stringy and black, and I wore it way down over my shoulders. Had it one hanging over the eye, you know. And I always had a cigarette in the corner of my mouth, and I never took it out. I mean, I talked to you with it in there. It kind of bobbed up and down, you know, when I was talking. And I make up way out to here, you know, shaking. And they come to the door, and the first one to walk in was a real good-looking guy. I thought, now, this may not be a bad deal here, boy. No. This one might not be too bad, and I was sizing him up pretty good, but right behind him came Rebecca Sunnybrook Farm. I'm telling you, I knew they sent the Holy Rollers to save my soul, and I didn't want to go. Because she just looked the part, you know. I mean, she was a lady. You could tell by looking at her she was a lady. And she had on a little princess coat. It was brown with a brown velvet collar. Those little itty-bitty petite heels, you know. And I was used to the platforms, man. And she comes in with these little petite heels. A hair, not a hair out of place. I'll never forget it. And her name was Bunny. So I remember taking a drag off the cigarette and saying, boy, this is going to be a trip. I can tell it now. And I went to my first meeting, and it was much in a church like this one, you know, very much like this one. And that meeting, they were talking, went around the room, and the thing I remember most about the first meeting was the laughter that I heard. I remembered that, because it was a different kind of laughter. It wasn't the kind I'd heard around the bar. It was the kind that came from in here. You know, and the other thing I remembered was the way y'all looked at one another. You know, there was something different, something loving about the way y'all looked at one another. You know, and how you laughed with each other. You know, something different there. And I thought it was really neat that the guy that got me a cup of coffee only got me a half a cup. You know, I just thought that was wonderful that he knew that, and I found out other people hid bottles. And I thought that was great. You know, I had bottles, and I lived alone. I don't know who I was hiding them from. But other people had bottles, and that was great. And I didn't say much during the meeting, and at the end of the meeting, Buddy, the man that 12-stepped me, said, Judy, do you have any questions? Is there anything you'd like to know about us? And I said, no, I just don't want to get drunk anymore. I am sick to death being drunk. And he reached over the table and he patted my hand. And he made me a promise. And he said, baby, you don't ever have to drink again. You don't ever have to be drunk again. And I believed it. And I don't know why I believed it. But somehow I knew this man wasn't lying to me. I went to my first meeting on the better side of town, of course, and I had a bad problem with my mouth, okay, and I had a bad problem with the way I dressed, and I didn't have a lot of social skills to the extent that I was putting. I was going for some of the women's husbands there, and it was amazing to me how they tolerated me and how kind they were to me, because the bravest of the bunch came to me when I was about 11 days sober, and she said, Judy, there's a group on the other side of town we really think you'd enjoy. And at 11 days sobriety, I went into the Atlanta Biscayne Room. And once again, God was working for me, because that's where I found people like me. You see, even though I knew that I belonged with you all somehow, these women out in this group, I mean, these were married ladies. They were ladies. And I didn't know how to act around them. I didn't know what to say to them. And I'd been with guys. I didn't know how to talk to women. They made me nervous. You know, one of them came up and gave me the phone number and said, call me. I felt like saying, for what? You know, I couldn't cope with that kind of stuff, you know? I just couldn't cope. And I went over, I did get away over to the Biscayne, and it was great, because there were people, and there was a woman there that cussed as much as I did. And that was great, you know, because I had a hard time with that. You know? See, I didn't have, at one time in my life, I had social skills. At one time in my life, I knew how to behave. But you see, I'd lost all that. I'd lost all that. And the filth and the trash that I lived in became part of me. And the filth and the trash was all I knew. You know, that's all I knew. You know, I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know how else to behave. You know, my stepfather had taken us out to find places to eat. I didn't know how to behave out in public anymore. I just didn't know. I felt awkward. I felt insecure. I was scared. I didn't know what to say. You know, I was just scared. You know, a lot of times I hear people talking about people's mouths in meetings. Trust me, they don't know they sound that bad. Okay? And a man did a very fine service for me when I was early in the program. I was about 8 months sober. And I came into the room one day just cussing. The air was blue, man. I was mad. And just every word I could think of. And Jimmy was a soft and loving and gentle man. And Jimmy came up to me and he said, Judy, you're such a pretty girl. Why do you cuss so much? I said, hell, Jimmy, I don't know. You know? But he got me thinking. He got me thinking. Well, you know, I read a lot. I know the English language. You know? Maybe I could try. But I didn't want to give it all up at once. So I started tapering off on my cussing, see? And I did. I quit using the Lord's name in vain. And that's where I started. And now I can talk for hours and never use a cuss word. No. But see, I wasn't aware that needed to be changed. Now, I think it's our responsibility as members of Alcoholics Anonymous, if someone is here and not socially acceptable, we need to tell them. No. There was a guy in the room named Dad. And Dad was a little bantamweight, mean little merchant marine. And I loved him. Oh, my God, I loved that man. And Dad took me aside one time when I was early in the program. And I wanted to fight a woman that was in the room. And he pulled me aside and he sat me down. And he said, Judy, he said, if you're going to fit back into society, you've got to quit hitting people. And then he gave me a beautiful, beautiful lesson, and I carried it with me. And he said, Judy, you can't live like a drunk, honey, and expect to stay sober. You got to change. You got to change. And what that means is, even today, I can't expect to act like a drunk and expect sobriety. I can't live like a drunk and expect peace of mind. I can't do that. I can't lie, you know, and expect to feel good about myself. I had a horrible time with lying. You know, it just came so naturally for me, as it does for most of us. You know, it just came real easy. And I wanted to stop lying because I always felt bad when I lied. I felt badly about myself. And most of the time, there really wasn't any excuse for lying other than I could get away with it. That was about it. You know, so I began to say, every time I told a lie when I was talking to somebody, I'd say, no, that's a lie. And then I tell them the truth. Now, I'll tell you what that did for me, and what it'll do for you if you use it. You'll either quit lying or quit talking, one or the other. You know? And there was a long time there. I was real quiet because I couldn't open my mouth without popping something out. I had a hard time in getting, when I got to the program, about getting into the steps. And I understand people that come to us and they don't understand the Big Book, because I didn't understand the Big Book. I didn't understand what the Big Book was trying to tell me as far as changing my life. All I knew is what I saw in these rooms. All I knew was what I saw people doing and how they were changing their lives. And for a long time early on in sobriety, I didn't do a lot of talking, but I did a lot of watching. You know, I wanted to see what you did when you went out to eat. Were you rude to the waitress? You know, I watched for stuff like that. You know, I just watched. And the people that seem to be pretty contented are the ones that I'd stand a little closer to. The ones that I listened to a little more. And you know what I looked for? It was not what kind of car they drove or what side of town they lived on. What I looked for was that sparkle in their eyes, because every winner had it. You know, it was kind of that peace and that glow and kind of love just came out. You know, and they had it. There wasn't any of the anxiety that bops around. It was just mellow, just nice, you know, and that's what I wanted. I saw that peace in their face, and that's what I wanted. And those are the ones I gravitated to, the ones I wanted to be close to, the ones I wanted to spend time with. I also didn't want to spend time with any sanctimonious spiritual leaders, because I couldn't handle that. I really couldn't handle that. It was real difficult for me, and I'm talking not just the first couple of months, I'm talking the first 3 years, all right? It was real difficult for me to cope with anything close to reality. I was one of those people that had to run to the room when I got off work so I wouldn't get drunk. No. Now, maybe that's not true for some of you, but for me it was. It was real difficult for me some days to stay off the streets. No. And there's a madness out there. And if any of you have been out there, you know, if you've ever been out on the streets, there's something that happens around midnight to your body. And you just got to go. No. It's just like something out there is calling you. And I had more trouble with midnight madness than anything else. And I just couldn't handle it. I had to go back out and see what's going on out there. See what's happening out there. And that was deadly for me. That was deadly for me. No, so I was around people who understood that. I was around people who knew that. I was around people who'd say, I understand if you can't read the Big Book, but you're going to have to learn how to live sober. You know, so why don't you try As Bill Sees It? Why don't you try Cain to Believe? They knew I didn't want anything to do with God. I didn't want anything to do with God. You know? But they gave me those suggestions. And they gave me some ideas of things to do. They told me to go to 90 and 90. And I missed one meeting in my first 90 days. And I had a case of the flu, the real flu this time. And I couldn't go to the meeting. So the next Sunday I went to 3, you see, because I was so afraid if I didn't, my sobriety would be jinxed and y'all wouldn't let me stay. No, y'all wouldn't let me stay. There were some things that I listened to, and I listened to very strongly, and other things I totally ignored. And one of those things was that you shouldn't make any major decisions your first year in sobriety. But now I'm 23. I need to get married. I thought about looking for a husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is not hard to do. I had 3 months sobriety. I found him. At 4 months sobriety, we were married, and he had 5 months sobriety. And the elders in my group just sat back and watched. One of them told me years later, he said, you know, we never wanted to let you know this, but we were taking bets on how long you two were going to last. But see, there again, even though the action was wrong, on the inside, I had it that if I was married, I'd be like a lady, you know. I'd settle down and I'd do those right things, because that's what they told me was the right thing to do. And I was trying to do the right thing. I really was trying to do the right thing. I knew it wasn't good for me to live like I'd lived before I got here. I couldn't be jumping in and out of bed with every man. You know, I knew that, and I knew I needed to settle down. And I knew that marriage was going to help fix me now that I was sober. And it did. We made another decision my first husband in the South, we decided that it was the big city of Atlanta that was messing us up. See? So what we needed to do was move to a small community where life was quiet and serene, you know, and it'd be easier for us to stay sober. I am asphalt and concrete and have been all my life. I've never lived in the country. I didn't know anything about country living. I was one of those alcoholics who got to AA, and I wasn't able to get my financial things in order right away, so I was not able to buy new clothes. So I had the clothes that I had when I was working Peachtree. And at 9 months sobriety, I am walking main streets of Hiawassee in white go-go boots and black fishnet hose. And I found it real difficult to understand why those people couldn't accept me. And my mouth was still bad, you know, I still hadn't got it in line yet. And I was making a lot of people up there real uncomfortable. There's a beautiful part to that, though, and again, God was working in my life, you see, because I had wanted no part of God. I signed God out of my life a long time ago. I told him, just you take care of your business, man, I'll take care of mine. That's it. And up there in Hiawassee, there was a 8-acre lake. My first husband and I had a horrible fight, and I took my two dogs and I walked by that 8-acre lake. And I sat down on a grassy knoll, and behind that lake is a beautiful mountain. And I hurt, and I never hurt like that before. You know? And this time I got no buffer. This time I got nothing to ease the pain, and I'm stone cold sober. You know? And I was dying inside. And I remember looking up there and saying, God, I don't know if you're up there. And I don't know if you can hear me. But I got to have some relief or I'll drink again. And I don't want to drink again. I don't want to get drunk again. And it was as though, you know, how a good friend puts his arm around you and kind of pats you on the shoulder and says you're going to be okay. That's what I felt that day. It wasn't that God came down and told me anything to do. I just had a sense of being okay. I just knew I didn't have to drink. I didn't have to drink. No. And the joy came to me because for the first time in my life, I was a child of God. No. I was a child of God. I was 24 years old. I didn't know that. No. And I got up from that little grassy knoll, and I can remember even feeling better when I walked, man, you know. I just didn't feel like trash anymore. No. I was a child of God. Oh. It's a good feeling, you know what I'm saying? Makes you cry at everything. Because see, for so long in my life, I heard things like you're trash. And you're never going to be anything but trash. And one of these days, somebody's going to blow your head off. You know? And I can remember sitting there thinking, God, I wish they would get me out of this. You know? And all of a sudden, I feel like I'm worthwhile. All of a sudden, I feel like I ought to do something with my life. And I came back to Atlanta, and that marriage lasted 2.5 years. And I learned a lot about me, and I learned a lot about staying sober. And I had known my husband Craig for 2 years, and unbeknownst to me, he had gotten married, and he was filing for divorce, and long and short of that is we got together, and we've been married 14 years. And it's been a good marriage. And there were a lot of changes that went on, you see, because at around 3 years, I decided I might ought to get serious about this thing. And I started going to meetings with the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, up until this time, I stayed with the men, and it was not because of the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was because of me. But I want to share with you guys in particular how important it is that two men in my home group loved me, you know, as a fellow alcoholic. And these guys had 12 years and 8 years, and they were the ones that acted as my sponsors those first 3 years. They were the ones that shared with me their experience, their strength, their hope. They were the ones that gave me the guidance, because they wanted this alcoholic to get well. They wanted nothing more. And I will be eternally grateful to those two men. You know, they walked this program. They knew I was sick, but they knew I needed help. And they saved my life. But I got with some of the women in the program, and I started going to meetings with the women. And I started studying the Big Book. And I started studying the 12 of 12. Now, I really didn't get into the Big Book real well until I was almost 5 years sober. And it's not because I didn't try. I did try. And I suggest to you that if you're having a hard time with the Big Book, keep trying. I couldn't understand it. It wouldn't register. But the 12 of 12 started making sense. And so I did the best I could to start working those steps, to understand, to ask questions. I went to 12 and 12 study groups so that I could understand what this thing was trying to tell me. You know, I started asking questions. I went to Big Jim one time. I said, you know, I start working these steps like y'all want me to. I'm kind of worried. And he said, well, what about? And I said, well, the way I understand them, if I work these steps, I'm going to end up one of those gray-haired, tight-lipped old ladies just walking around going, you know. And I said, I don't want to do that, Jim. I don't want to grow up to be that, you know. And I was worried. I mean, this was a big deal. I was so afraid I was going to get, you know, real good, you know. And I told Jim that, and he did like y'all. He laughed a little bit, and then he said, don't worry about it, baby. It'll never happen. And I believed Jim. I believed him. And I was like, okay, it's okay then. I can work them. It's all right. I can get started on them. You know, because when you're talking about going to a God and turning your will and mind, that's scary. I mean, that was scary. You know, I didn't want that. And I saw in the way that they lived what that really meant. You know, I saw in the way that they lived that meant when major decisions came up in their lives, that they went to their sponsors and their spiritual advisors and to God to try and make those decisions of how to live and what's the right thing to do. You know, that's what I saw in them. You know, I saw the love and the tolerance in them. I saw the love and the tolerance in them when I would come in and I'd be on a self-pity trip. You know, and I didn't want any part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want any part of it. Between 2.5 and 3 years, I came real close to killing myself because I couldn't stand sobriety. I just couldn't stand sobriety. I'd go to meetings and I'd sit on my hands, you know, and I'd think my head's going to explode just any minute. I was insane. You know, I was absolutely nuts. And they'd come up and they'd talk to me. And sometimes, you know, they'd ask me what was wrong and I'd say nothing. And they'd walk off. And they'd let me stand there and suffer just as long as I wanted. You know? Because it was up to me. You see, what I learned from people like Big Jim and Dad was, your sobriety is your responsibility. It is not mine. It is not my responsibility to call you every day to make sure that you're going to a meeting. If you want what we have, you will go to a meeting. That's just the way it was with them. That's just the way it was with my sponsors, with the people that guided me in this program. You know, one of the things they used to ask me when I'd say, well, when do I have to do this step? Or when do you want to get feeling better? You know, they made suggestions, but they always followed it up with, well, you could get drunk. You know, and somehow that suggestion became a lot more powerful when it was followed with that phrase. They just didn't. They didn't listen to a whole lot of my stuff. No, I'd come up with some kind of song and dance, and they'd be very descriptive in what they thought that was. You know, and they cared enough about me not to worry about hurting my feelings. No, they made it real clear to me right up front that they weren't my counselor, and I'm so glad they taught me that. They made it real clear to me they were just another alcoholic And the only difference between me and them was the length of time since the last drink. That was all. And I'd say something to them about, when am I going to be feeling like you are? It'll happen. There's not that much difference. I've just been at this thing longer than you. That's all. And they understood. They understood where I was coming from. They explained to me living. They explained to me things like being responsible. They explained to me things like not being selfish and self-centered. No. They explained to me that when I didn't behave properly in a meeting, that I needed to be thinking of others and not myself. No. That perhaps my behavior made other people uncomfortable, and perhaps it wasn't up to them to adjust, but me to adjust as to what was socially acceptable. They were not always kind, but they were always loving. They were always loving. And it was beautiful. And when I can remember the first year I was sober, my first birthday, and I really hadn't moved up in the world too much because all I had was burgundy satin hot pants. But that was all right because I was sober. I had gone 24 hours without a drink. God, what a glorious miracle. What a glorious miracle. At 5 years sobriety, I was doing an inventory and I came to the realization of what one doctor told me. And it scared me half to death. Because he said, Judy, you are suicidal, homicidal, which means we can't let you out. What that means in essence is you are of danger to yourself and to society. And I was 5 years sober before I realized what that man was telling me. I was 5 years sober before I realized how sick I had really been. They taught me about responsibility, and they taught me to work, and they taught me to care. And they taught me that if I was going to stay sober, I'd have to give it back. And I remember the first time I did something nice for somebody in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a drunk in the room and he was drying out and nobody else was in there but he and I. And I remember thinking, Jim says I got to do something nice. Maybe I ought to do something nice for this guy. And he was going through the hot, cold sweats. So I ran in the back room, and got him a blanket. And then I looked out in the front to make sure nobody could see me doing something nice. And I just went over and kind of threw that blanket around him and said, I hope you get feeling better. And then I ran over and sat down in my chair because I didn't want anybody to catch me being nice. See, I was such a tough little broad, I didn't want y'all getting through. I didn't want y'all knowing that I really wanted to be a decent person. I just didn't want y'all to know. And that's where it started. You see, because that drunk looked up at me with those blurry eyes and said, thank you. That was real nice. And that's where it started. That's where it started. We have, my husband and I have brought drunks to our home. And one particular weekend, the room was packed and they couldn't take any more, so we brought a couple over to the house. And both of them had about 48 hours sobriety. They were just about at the point where they were ready to eat. So the following day, I fixed a big dinner. And it was on a Sunday, I'll never forget it. Fixed a big dinner. And I mean to tell you, honey, there wasn't even grease left on the plate, I mean, it's great to see them when they come in off the streets, they hadn't had a decent meal, and all of a sudden, God, they want to eat again. And I made it good. I homemade biscuits and, all that stuff, and they just loved it. And that look in their eye, and you could tell they were starting to feel good. And our 12 and 12 talks about the joy of watching somebody get better. And that's the joy. Because you see someone who 3 days before, you looked in their eyes and you saw absolutely nothing. There was no sign of life there, man. None. And 3 days later, you see him sitting at a table and laughing and eating a good meal. And thank God I was able to be part of that. And my little girl's at a sponsor in the program. And it's a joy. It's a joy to be able to give this program. You give back some of what the program gave to me. And to see them walk up to my home, and to see them upset and crying, and to see them knowing that there's just no reason to live anymore, and to have them tell me the same thing I felt. Sobriety's not worth it, man. You know, I'm doing everything y'all tell me to do, and my life still stinks. It's just not worth it. And to sit down with a big book and a pot of coffee and an ashtray, and an hour later, I can't wait to get started again. And to know that God allows you to be a part of that. To know that when I go to my mama's house today, and I sit and I visit and we talk and we laugh, and I get ready to leave, and she looks at me and she says, "Do you have to go so soon? Can't you stay a little longer, Jesus?" No. That's alcoholism. That's what you all gave to me. Do you have to go so soon? I'm a regular civilian today. Yeah. I go to work every day. And it blows my mind, you see, because when I go to work now, see, I wear high heels and long skirts, you know, and I carry a briefcase. And I go in and I call on people, these big execs, you know, sit up in their ivory towers and go in there and talk to them like I know what I'm doing, and just amazes me. I walk out, and in Atlanta, they have a lot of these office doors, these big glass buildings, you know, and the glass office doors, and I see that reflection coming out of that building. You know? And I know intellectually it's me, but man, I can't believe it. You know? And sometimes God and I will be walking back to the car and we kind of giggle with each other and say, it'd be funny if they really knew who they were talking to, wouldn't it? Yeah. And to have the respect, you know, of your family and your peers, the people you work with. And to have the respect of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, which to me is the greatest compliment. And to walk out and know that you're a child of God and that you got a right for happiness. You got a right to be smiling. You got a right to feel good and clean inside. Oh, it's glorious. It's glorious. I have many friends in the fellowship today. Recently, my husband elected to go back out and drink again after 9.5 years sobriety. And my friends came to me from all over. And they called and they were there. They didn't make a pest of themselves, but they loved me. And I was grateful. And I had another big decision to make in my sobriety, and that was, do I or don't I go to an Al-Anon meeting? And I have a very, very dear friend of mine who is in Al-Anon. And she suggested, she said, try it. And I called my sponsor and she said, try it. And I want everyone to know that when I attended my first Al-Anon meeting, I was greeted with all the warmth and love and caring that I was greeted at my first AA meeting. Nobody said to me, well, you're an alcoholic, you ought to know. No. Nobody was unkind. They were loving and they shared with me what good AA members do. They shared with me their experience, strength, and hope. I've always loved Al-Anons anyway because, you know, those women did things stone cold sober. I did drunk, so they got to have something to them. Yeah, but my Craig is back in the program now, and I'm grateful. And I'm grateful to y'all for that. And then I think about things like this weekend. When times get rough in sobriety, and when times get tough in sobriety, please think about weekends like this. And what I do, and it helps me so much, is to think about the people who brought me joy. You know, I told you about Dad, and Dad's going on to glory now. He was one of the men that helped me so much early on. But I still think about Dad when I get a little down. I still think about the way he used to take that little finger and put it right in my face and say, if you don't do what I'm... I still think about it because it just makes me laugh. You know, just makes me laugh. And it makes me feel good inside. And I still see the love that I saw in his eyes. And then I think about trips like this weekend and being able to spend time with Mary, one of my friends. Mary and I have the same home group. We attend Saturday night owls. And we meet at the Atlanta Biscayne Room. We meet at 11 o'clock every Saturday night. And Mary's our oldest member, sobriety. It's about 46 years, Mary? Something like that. Give or take a few, 46, you know, so what? But I love her so much, and she means so much to me. And there again is loving and caring. And those are the things you hold on to, because not every day is going to be good, baby. You know, some days about the only thing you can do is just, by God, don't drink. That's it. But if you do that, you're all right. You're all right. And see, normal people don't have beautiful days every day either. You know, but just don't drink. And then when that day is over and you're finished with work, go to a meeting and tell them you've had a lousy day. Don't sit there with 10 years sobriety and just because you've got 10 years sobriety, suffer. Doesn't work. When I am asked to speak, I always remember that, you know, my sponsor, one of my sponsors, Maggie, I have two sponsors now, Maggie and Billy B. And one of my sponsors, Maggie's the one that tells me that I am to dress up, that I am to look sober whether I act sober or not. I know, but I am also reminded, because of what I've learned here, that I don't ever want to clean up so well I forget what it's like to be dirty. I don't ever want to clean up so well that when one of those little tramps come in off the street, I forget what it's like to go up and talk to her. I forget the pain that she's feeling. I don't ever want to forget what that pain is like. I want to make sure that if there's any way possible, I can go to that baby and say, you're a child of God and you're worth it, honey. And you don't ever have to drink again and let us show you how. No. That I can take her to my home and let her bathe in my tub and not worry about what kind of disease am I going to catch, because this is a suffering alcoholic. She needs somebody to love her. For the love of God, she doesn't need anybody else looking down on her. She's had that for years. She needs somebody to put their arms around her and say, come on, baby, you can live better and let us show you how. I don't ever want to clean up to the point I forget what that's like. See, because I'm always afraid I may be the next one that comes through the door if I forget where I came from. Yeah. I appreciate y'all's attention. Mary, I didn't bring my reading glasses.
Old.
July 27th, August 2nd, I got these. And I was going to try, but you just can't back up far enough, so I always close with this paragraph in the Big Book because it is one of my favorites. There's a lot of favorite paragraphs I have in the Big Book, but this one is one of my favorites. And if you don't know where it is, you read the book till you find it. And it says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you all very much.